And today we're going to look at the influence of the smartphone, of social media, and of persuasive technology on adolescent development, but not only on their development, honestly, on our development also. Okay, so we'll touch on both. So my name is Christy Williams. I love studying social sciences and young people, and I've been doing that for almost 18 years as a full-time missionary living in Ukraine. That is where I live and have ministered many years with my husband. We're originally from Chicago, and we work for a missionary organization called Josiah Venture, where we train and equip young leaders. Now, I'd like to start with a question, and you can answer this question for me. Basically, it's two questions. One, what worries you the most about technology's influence on our brains? And then at the same time, what do you think God's answer is to that worry? Because he calls us to be worried about nothing, but we know that technology is creating certain problems in our society. Those are legitimate concerns to have as we enter into this kind of digital and tech space. And then we have to think to ourselves, okay, well, what's God's promise for us as we see things that are concerning us in our society? As I was thinking about this question, my thought was, it's like it's a battle for our minds. What's the spiritual principle behind like our digital use? For me, it's that the enemy wants to take my mind captive. God wants my mind for himself. And so when I look at scripture, I see a couple things. One, I do feel like we're at risk. Now, the Apostle Paul told the church in Corinth that everything's permissible, but not everything's beneficial. And the conclusion he came to, although he wasn't talking about smartphones at that time, of course, his conclusion was we will not be enslaved or mastered by something. Let's let the Holy Spirit be the one that masters us, that has our control, not anything else. Think about when God was talking to Cain at the very beginning. He warns Cain and he says, Cain, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you. What must you do? You must master it. Again, we see this word, taking agency, taking control, taking responsibility of what we put into our minds. And that is on us. So when we look at the positive side of this, of taking responsibility, think about Paul. He's writing to the Philippians and he wants to tell them, listen, don't worry about anything and everything through prayer. Present your request to God. And a way that you can battle all of these fears is by filling your mind with whatever's good and just and fair and lovely and praiseworthy. Think about these things. And then what happens a verse later, he says, the God of peace comes and restores our mind. And as we talk about young people, as we talk about their anxious, their depression, the things that are really troubling them. And as we look at, is this correlated? Is this caused by the smartphones and by our tech? We know that God says, listen, what we've set our mind on matters. So today in our presentation, we're going to look at four objectives. The first one is, I need to convince you that there's a reason why we should study this. Two, we want to look at how the teenage brain functions kind of at a normative level. Before then, we go into what are the stressors? What are the main areas of risk for brain development when we're mixing it with technology? And then lastly, we want to look to our Savior. We look to Jesus. And what was his response? Well, Christ's response is always one of hope and one of peace, right? Christ's response is one of love and compassion for the people. And we also see discipline. And so what does it mean to be disciplined with our devices? We're seeing high levels of anxiety and depression. We're seeing high levels of self-harm and suicide attempts and loneliness. And this isn't just typical teenage angst that happens year after year, decade after decade. Young people are hurting. And so the question is, what's going on? And one of the biggest concerns is the doctors are seeing problems starting between age 10 and 14. This is like even pre-adolescent years. Now we're seeing troubles in that age group. And also, too, we're starting to see that the rise of these mental health questions are coming across continents, across gender. It's boys, it's girls, it's in many different places. So what is happening? Now, in 2011, a guy named Nicholas Carr wrote a book called The Shallows, what the internet is doing to our brains. And if I'm honest with you, in 2011, that was the year I got my first smartphone, and I was not worried at all what the internet was doing to our brains. No one was listening, maybe, it seems. 2017, years later, Dr. Jean Twenge, who loves to study the next generation, she writes a great book that we read in seminary called The I Generation. Look at the tagline to the book. Why today's super connected kids are growing up less rebellious, more tolerant, less happy, and completely unprepared for adulthood. Now, Dr. Twenge was concerned about something, but I read that book that year, and I remember being like, And look at the black star. Time magazine commented on the front of the book, interesting. So the society wasn't necessarily responding to these questions then, but now we fast forward to 2024, and some people are saying we have a real like epidemic of mental health for the younger generation on our hands. So let's look at some data. These are seven graphs. Taken from studies from the US, the UK, the Nordic countries, different countries across Europe, and a few studies across the continents. And what these graphs are all measuring is the increase in depression, anxiety, loneliness. We have self-harm, hospitalization, high psychological distress, and other anxious tendencies. These graphs span around 2000 to 2020. People are starting to get concerned. But before we look at specific patterns, I want to introduce one resource that I found interesting. This is Dr. Jonathan Haidt, and he is a social scientist and a moral psychologist, and he just released two months ago the book, The Anxious Generation. And he believes there's a rewiring of the mind happening and why the rewiring of childhood is causing an epidemic of mental illness. He was the one who turned my attention to these graphs, and he is definitely concerned and writing about his concern as well. Now, before we start to look at what might be happening, this connection between different things in the tech world and what's going on in mental health with young people, let's take a look at the brain. Let's look at a few normative brain functions in teenagers, just to give you a review if you don't, or something new if you don't already know this. So here we have five pictures of the brain and it's kind of cross sections of it. The goal of this picture is to get to a fully blue brain, which means it's fully connected. That means all of the brain cells, the neurons are firing, the synapses are growing, it's wiring together and connecting all of the different parts of our brain to one another for full function, we would say, of the brain. But scientists noticed two things. They recognized that one, the brain develops from the back to the front. So this, the prefrontal cortex area is where we develop last. Not only is that where the executive functions lie, and we'll talk about why this part of development is so important a little bit later, but they also noticed that that part was not fully wired until around the age of 25, which surprised doctors because they thought that young people were adult when their body stopped going through puberty around the age of 18. They thought that the brain was fully developed. No, it's actually not fully developed until the mid-20s, which has a lot of bearing on how we interact with young people and how we help them in their development. Now, one of the best things about the teenage brain is that it is ripe for learning. They say age 15 is peak learning age. We can learn at any age, which is great. But around the age of 15 is when the synapses are firing the fastest, when those connections are made, when information is flying through. That means it's great for memory. It's great for learning new things. It's great for creating healthy habits. It's not so great for creating negative habits because the brain doesn't differentiate between good and bad habits. It just keeps that data moving through the brain faster and faster. And around the age of 15 also is when the brain starts to say, oh my goodness, we have overgrowth happening because the brain is so ripe for learning that we have to start pruning. We have to start cutting off neuropathways that aren't going anywhere, that haven't been used, that haven't been exercised. So the brain cuts away what's not necessary and keeps that which we pay attention to. The brain doesn't know what to keep. We tell our brain what's important based on where we put our energy, our effort, and our attention, okay? Now, it's great that the brain can learn, but they have a major, major vulnerability in the limbic system. That's the system inside of the center of the brain where these things lie. That's where hormones live. That's where emotions live. That's where stress responses live. That's where the amygdala lives with fight, flight, or flee, or freeze. And so let's start with hormones. We all have hormones. They flow out of our body like a leaky bathroom faucet at most ages, except from the ages of 11 to 17, when hormones are flowing through the body from the brain at a rate like coming out of a fire hose. And the challenging thing is that you can't turn this off. There is absolutely nothing we can do. Why is this a problem? Well, part of it's 11 to 17 usually. This is when puberty kicks off, and around the age of 11, it just starts turning on. And then again, around the age of 17, 18, it turns off. Now, one of the reasons why this is such a problem is that this flow is located directly next to the emotional center of the brain. So that causes heightened emotions, more aggression, more sadness, more ups and more downs. So when we look at teenagers and we say, why are they so emotional? It's because of things that are happening chemically inside of their body that they really don't have much control over. We often blame them for a lot of things that they only have partial control over. Like, we're all responsible for our actions. At the same time, there's a lot of bio and a lot of physiological things going on. Also, something that's sad, in teenage brains, we all have a chemical that helps us to regulate stress. But in the teenage years, the stress regulator that adults have causes us to calm down when we face a stressful situation. In teenagers, they carry stress up to 33 times heavier than adults. So if you needed to fill out a college application, that's fine. You're going to sit down, you'll fill it out, you'll write the essay, no big deal. For them, it can be up to 33 times more stressful, and they don't have the chemicals to calm them down, but they also are missing this. The prefrontal cortex, the last part of their brains to develop, is very much under construction. It's not that they don't have these functions, it's that they're underdeveloped significantly. It's kind of like really thin hair. Like, imagine like all of these like wirings that are happening, really good, strong connection. And then up here, it's just kind of like little hairs. And the more we use those functions, the stronger the pathways get. But a lot of times young people, they don't know how to use these functions. They're not great at planning and organizing. They don't make wise decisions. They need adults like us to walk alongside them to help them practice those habits so that those pathways can get stronger. Otherwise, we're going to wait until they're 25 for all of those things to connect. So they need our help. But why is this such a problem in this topic? Well, you are giving a smartphone to an 11-year-old who has absolutely limited ability to do these things. So why would that be a problem? Well, imagine they have very little impulse control. It's very hard to resist temptation. They don't have self-awareness. They're not other-centered. And so honestly, it's a concoction, it's a combo that they don't have the brain functions strong enough to be able to resist a lot of the problematic things that go along with tech. So if you're ready, here we go. Let's take a look at tech. We just looked at science. We just looked at biology. Most of the things I told you are kind of true about biology across the ages. But now we're going to enter into our cultural zone and our historical zone, which influences us, meaning, well, what's going on in our day and age that's different, let's say, than when I grew up, or maybe when you grew up, or when our grandparents grew up. So beginning in 2004, is the birth year of Facebook. Facebook is 20 years old this year, hard to believe. And let me read you just a stat. Today there are 3 billion monthly users on Facebook and over a billion people with daily use. Friends, that's a powerful platform just by number of users, okay? 2007, Steve Jobs announces the release of the iPhone. Interestingly enough, it was the day I moved to Ukraine, so I know exactly how old the iPhone is. It's 17, almost 18 years old. 2009, IT tech guys created the like button. So we go from pictures and comments to being able to give some, let's say, some social capital to those pictures and to those posts. 2010, the birth of the iPad. So now we can take our computers and our phones with us in our pockets everywhere, which coincides very interestingly with the end of Generation Z and the birth of Generation Alpha. If you study generational theory, you know that oftentimes a break from one gen to the next is related to things going on in society. So Gen Alpha basically begins when these devices become something that they can basically that they have in their cribs. We say they're born with a phone in their hand. And it's not a Nokia phone that you can text on. It's smartphones with apps and social platforms and all of the bells and whistles. So this Gen Alpha, the youngest generation right now, born from 2010 to around today, makes them the oldest, they're 14, and the youngest, they're in elementary school or babies even. I don't know what the next gen is. I haven't looked at what the next gen is. Okay, let's keep going on the timeline. Capitalism joins the party in 2012 when Facebook buys Instagram, and they decide this is great. We're going to do paid advertising on all of our platforms. So suddenly we move from the user being the customer to the reality is it's the advertising companies that are actually the customer for these platforms. And so together their goal is to make sure that they keep our attention as long as possible because the longer we're on, the more money people make. And that's just how big business works. That's not conspiracy theory. It's just true. Another interesting finding from 2012 is the year of the selfie. Because that was the year that the front-facing camera came out. So suddenly we have everyone facing themselves, taking pictures of themselves and becoming more and more obsessed with images that can go online in now this new form. Now, going back to, if we were to go back to those graphs, and I actually forgot to, so I'm going to, take a look here. I didn't mention the black bar on the graphs, which is around 2012. And social scientists and doctors and people who study data say, interestingly enough, around 2010, 2012, all of these kinds of graphs are taking what we call up and to the right around that time. That there's steady increases of things, but people say, and sometimes they can prove causation and sometimes they can't, sometimes it's just correlation, but they're saying, people, something's happening in these years, we need to pay attention. And I don't know about you, but I wonder, is it really a coincidence that all of these things are happening around the same time that the mental health situation just continues to get worse and worse? And we have a generation that is totally trapped inside of their devices. And not just one generation, it affects all of us. But this youngest generation, it's becoming worse and worse the younger you get. So if we keep going, one theory that this particular scientist has is he says there's something going on with play-based childhood and phone-based childhood. So these kids that grew up on social platforms always having a device in their hand in their pocket. We've overprotected children in the real world where they need a lot of free play, a lot of autonomy, not parents hovering over them, trying to keep them safe and kind of control their environment all the time. But we've underprotected them online, where they're not mentally, developmentally able to handle all of the threats, all of the adult content that's on there that is with them 24/7. So real quick, if we were to look at, well, what's play-based childhood and phone-based childhood? His theory is that, well, play-based is what you would think. Taking risk, being outside, practicing imagination, creativity, curiosity, having some authority over them, but also having a lot of freedom, overcoming fears, like getting resilience and strength, and socializing face-to-face. So much of play-based childhood is being in person with people versus a phone-based childhood, which this guy jokingly said, but not joking, that we're blocking 4,000 years of typical child development by giving them devices that are leading to less sleep, less play, less in-person, 24/7 availability and social comparison, isolation, hiding, and addiction. Okay. interesting, something worth chewing on. What is life like when you have a phone-based or a play-based childhood? Now, the premise is that there's a couple areas of harm that we need to be paying attention to. Because what we're seeing in the younger generations is we're seeing addiction, attention fragmentation, sleep deprivation, and social deprivation. So these are our four categories that we're going to look at and say, okay, let's just check these areas. These are the areas to be most worried about, okay, potentially. Let me explain to you, if you don't know how the brain works with addiction. Okay, addiction is just a form of learning, okay? Everything's a form of learning. Learning comes through inputs, stimuli going through the five senses: eyes, nose, ears, mouth, hands, okay? So when we put narcotics, alcohol, nicotine, marijuana, some kind of substance, some chemical, we take it in through our mouth, through our vein, through our nose, and that substance goes to our brain just like any input for learning does, watching a film or whatever, and it goes to the pleasure center of the brain, which is the dopamine receptors, because the brain is always looking for pleasure, gratification, reward. The brain is created for reward, and that's why it loves learning, because it's so many inputs, and is there going to be something that's going to make me feel good while all of these things are coming into my mind? So when a substance like addiction comes in, rather than just the brain saying, oh, that was good, okay, pleasure, reward, gratification, the chemicals interact with the dopamine receptors, and it's like a big explosion that tells the brain, wire strong, don't let this one go, make this a habit, I love that, give me more now, I can't wait for the next one. Young people's brains are really, really vulnerable to addiction because they're so ripe for learning. If they start learning the wrong thing, including using these things, the connections are so much stronger. That's one of just the weaknesses of their brain, because it's so ready to take in good inputs, but it also takes in bad inputs. Now, that's how substance abuse works. But you can imagine that the scientists, the doctors, were shocked when they started being able to, you know, watch brain activity, and when we're watching pornography, and when we're gambling online, and when we're doing video gaming, and when we are doing social media, the same dopamine receptors, those pleasure centers, are going off, and they're going off stronger, like I said, than watching a film or reading a good book or going on a walk. There's something happening where these things are causing more dopamine to be released. And that's how addiction happens. But now let's look at smartphone addiction. Let's take it from kind of regular addiction areas to particularly our topic. So here you have your phone in your pocket or on the table. Now, remember, all learning is a form of input. So with a phone, with a device, the input is a notification, okay? Remember, inputs come in through the eyes, through the ears, through vibrations. So you can feel it if it goes off in your pocket. You can see it. It's a red dot, it's a flashing light, it's a banner, it's text, or you hear it, ba-bing, a reminder. And you know what happens to the brain with that? We're programmed now for this. The brain has a question mark of, huh, what was that? They're curious. And the phone is created, this word persuasive technology is created to draw us in. The device and the creators of the devices want us to look. So what happens? We pull out our device and we look. It's just natural. You can't not look, right? You really want to see what's going on in there. Now, these notifications are dopamine activating triggers. So that's why this smiley face is there. And that's why this funny meme, I like notifications, they make me feel wanted. Just the fact that something came into your device is telling you that you have a notification, tells the brain, pleasure, something good is happening there, okay? And so your brain wants to know, it checks. But after you get that dopamine hit, it's a micro hit, friends. It's not like taking cocaine, okay? I'm not comparing the two, but it's still dopamine release. When it releases, your brain says, I like that, I want it again. So suddenly you click to the next thing, because you liked how that first check felt, and so you're gonna go again. The next thing you know, you're scrolling, clicking, searching, and you are literally drawn into your phone, and you can't not keep looking because you want that next, the brain wants that next high. The problem is the next thing you look at, the high is a little bit less. Your brain starts to become resistant to that dopamine, so you need larger doses. So you stay on longer looking for pleasure. This is fascinating because this is all going on behind the scenes. You don't even know that this is happening in your brain, but now you do. Now, the former president of Facebook, Sean Parker, said, "I'm concerned," and he quit Facebook. He said, "This is not good." He said, "This is a social validation feedback loop. That we're validating people's presence on the internet, we're making them feel good, and we're exploiting them. There's a weakness, there's a vulnerability in the brain, and we're abusing it to keep them in as long as possible. And we repeat. Now, one definition of addiction is if you don't have this or if you don't do it, you're depressed, anxious, fearful. Think about an alcoholic with the bottle. If he doesn't have that nearby, he starts to get irritated. He starts to not function well. He needs it near him. And that's actually what we're seeing with young people with their phones. If they don't have their phone with them, they start to become irritated, worried, anxious, depressed, because that phone for them is a social lifeline, but it's also 24/7 connection. You know that because you now are connected 24/7 also. And there's a fear in young people because of their social connection. They want to know what's going on, and they absolutely don't want to be left out. So this is leading to compulsive media use. Have you ever noticed, like, young people sometimes walk around, like, holding their phones? I'm a youth leader. They, like, hold their phones like it's a baby, and they don't put them down. And a statistic I read recently says that they're checking their phones 85 times an hour. Friends, that's more than once a minute. That's a lot. And they said adults' statistic isn't that far less, actually, that we now are doing the same thing. We can't now just blame this on the younger generation. This is compulsive, right? If you have to look at something 85 times in an hour, we're so drawn in that we can't not look. So here's the danger: is you have this technology that's shaping our behavior. And then you couple it with this thing, we don't have time to go into it, but it's called surveillance capitalism. Fascinating book, fascinating TED Talks, and a whole different topic of saying it's all about the algorithms, right? That algorithms are written into, like, YouTube, TikTok, things that keep you engaged because they're just studying all of this data about you. And it's not even anytime, sometimes it's not even like private data, it's just all of your interests. Everything that you would want to know, they know about your patterns, about your habits. And so these are algorithms written to keep you clicking, to keep you looking, because it's not just any ad coming onto your site. It's things specifically created for you to be interested in. And honestly, oftentimes they really are interesting. And so you keep clicking and scrolling. But because the dopamine sensitivities of the brain that they're sensitive, young people are really vulnerable for this. So they do get addicted. And then the tolerance grows, so they need to keep doing it. And it's a lot of mindless content. Now, one last thing I want to say here is that one of the things that's so sad is that the notifications oftentimes are false alarms. You know what I mean? Like, you notice that, oh, something's happening, and you go to look for it, and, like, it's an advertisement from your bank. Like, there's nothing exciting about that. That wasn't something that gave you a lot of pleasure to see that your bank sent you a little text to tell you something about a feature. Big deal. No one cares. But the brain can't differentiate between good inputs and bad inputs. So the brain's excited anyways because something happened. And so you're kind of getting hijacked because the brain isn't differentiating. And then you get excited about the wrong things and you're still clicking, looking. So what do we do with that bad news? Let's reduce our stress inputs. So studies are showing that around after the 2-hour mark, people start to self-report negative feelings, anxiousness, stress, suicide, depression, after being online, after being on an app about 2 hours. So that's a great first step. Put your controls on to make sure that you're not spending more than 2 hours on social platforms. So let's just start there. That's still 2 hours a weekday. That's still a lot. For young people, that's like almost nothing, but let's start somewhere, okay? So that's my first bit of advice. We'll go through the advice as we go, but this is one to say, okay, what do we do in the addiction category? Well, if we're addicted, we need to take steps back. We need to stop using it so much. So reduce stress inputs and also turn off all notifications on your phone. I turned off all of my Messenger notifications. And I have two kids who are 13 and 12, and I don't care. I live in Ukraine where there's a war, and I don't care. I turned off notifications. If someone needs me, they can call me. I didn't turn off my phone. And you know what? It is giving me so much freedom. Like, I feel like another person. Like, I'm not looking at who's writing me every 24 seconds because people on, I don't know what apps you use. We use in Ukraine Telegram. On Telegram, people are writing me nonstop all the time. There's always inputs coming in. It's so good to know that when I'm ready to check it, I'll go in and check it. I know that there's messages there, but I'm choosing not to be able to see it, and it's actually changing my personal space. So turn off notifications, as many as you humanly can, and reduce amount of time on social media, okay? Yes, just the reminder too that there is, so when the anxious generation came out, when these graphs started coming out, some people who are anti this research, they say, well, you can't prove it because there's a lot of variables in our life. Well, what if it's COVID? What if it's a bad family situation? Anxiety, depression, suicidal tendencies, they can be for a whole bunch of reasons, and they're right. But there are studies that are showing some causality. And if you go to theanxiousgeneration.com, there's an entire website based on the research from the book. If you're kind of a scientist, if you're interested in looking at that, and it's totally worth looking at, okay? Now let's go to attention fragmentation and sleep deprivation, okay? Attention fragmentation. If you can do anything in this zone, stop believing that multitasking is a good thing. It's not. Bad news, friends. Multitasking hurts our brain. Our brain doesn't multitask. It goes from one neural pathway to the next, and it's constantly bouncing back and forth, and it stresses the brain because the flow is interrupted all the time. Now, just here, pay attention to the yellow, okay? So what we're finding is that when kids, you saw one of the memes or one of the GIFs on there, right? The boy who's on Minecraft, and he's playing Minecraft and he's on TikTok at the same time. That's very hard to do. He's quite talented, but not really. That's actually really bad for you. So it's creating poorer memory because the brain pathways aren't creating in the right places to help us with the memory function. Impulsivity, bounce back and forth. You can't stay on one thing. You're impulsive. You gotta go look over there, Constantly distracted, okay? If you ask me what my biggest worry about tech is, it's the second point. Inability to have long, mental, difficult thinking on something. That worries me about the professions of our future. Where are the surgeons? Where are the doctors? Where are the people doing very fine work that requires all of our attention? Now, we can reprogram the brain, and that's what's cool. It's like plasticity, brain plasticity, I forget what the word is, more like how it morphs and changes. It's adaptable. We can re-strengthen different areas, but the less we do it, the more weak the brain is in those areas. So we want to be able to do heavy lifting in the brain, heavy thinking, okay? And unfortunately, because this is giving them anxiety of everyone's online all the time, I want to know what's going on. Half of the time, they're not even listening in school, even if they don't have their phone with them, because they're wondering what they're missing, okay? They're not fully present and unable to give attention. When you jump from screen A to screen B or task A to task B, you actually bring the emotions and some of the brain stuff with you when you go to the second thing. And so you're actually not fully present in that second thing. So let's get rid of multitasking, okay? Honestly, my advice here, focus on one thing at a time and help your young people focus on one thing at a time. I don't remember what the statistic was, but a task can take so many, I forget, I used to have this in an old presentation. A task can take so much longer to do homework when you're multitasking because you get distracted so much easier. One thing and then another if you can. And then regarding sleep, remember that our young people, their bodies are going through tons of changes and rewiring and under construction. So they're tired. the body's doing a lot of brain work in them, plus all the hormones and all these things. So they need 8 to 9 hours of sleep, kind of like babies, like infants. They need to sleep a lot because their body's going through changes. The sleep needs to be quality and consistent, uninterrupted when possible. So that means the advice is absolutely no phones in the bedroom. You've probably heard that. It's real. Get devices, computers, laptops, iPads, phones out of the bedroom. In our house, no one, even the adults, do not have their phones in their bedroom. There's a phone in the bathroom as an alarm clock for me. My husband keeps his downstairs in a totally a different floor of the house. And my kids' phones are now in my room because they're sneaky and they will wake up and want to go look at something. I turned all of the notifications off. They can't get on, but they still want to see their phone anyways. So their phones are by my bed. Okay. I'm serious. You got to do these things, right? We have to take control over our actions. So get those devices out of the bedrooms. And why? Because sleep really helps with concentration, and they are still going to school. They do need other functions of their brain, not just scrolling, clicking. And also, one thing about sleep is the more sleep you get, the more you can emotionally regulate, which is good because they're struggling with emotional regulation. So if we can help them get those 8 to 9 hours of sleep, they're actually going to be in better moods and less emotionally volatile, which is good for us who have to deal with those emotions of theirs all the time. And then lastly, this one is really serious. We want them to develop the adult functions of the brain in the front, but if they're not sleeping, the synapses, those wirings, those branches, they can't connect in the same way when they're tired. And so we're actually not making the brain strong when we don't sleep. Now let's get to social deprivation, because this one is quite sad, the distance between people when devices are our lives. We think that we're connected because the phone was created actually to be connected, right? To write messages, to call, to see people's lives, but sometimes it's a false illusion of being connected. So the first concern that we have is that we need to work on engagement with the rest of life. You guys, we were created to be well-balanced people. We were not created to give all of our time and effort to one anything. We need a lot of things that help us become well-rounded and well-developed in a lot of different areas. The problem with the cell phone is that, or with the smartphone, is that for kids, for Gen Alpha, they do these tests. And kids, like, no matter what else, they give them a choice between an iPad and something else. And the something else could be absolutely fabulous. And they choose, they do these like psych experiments, they choose the iPad every single time. So again, this is about the age 0 to 14, okay? They're not able to recognize now the benefits of other things in life, this less engagement. So the advice is, so what's happening is they're giving so much attention, you know, we're talking like hours and hours and hours of attention to an online life that gives them something. But all of those other pathways and connectors that need to be connecting, like learning and like being outside and vacation and rest and learning how to be bored and learning how to create, learning life skills like cleaning and cooking and organizing things in their bedroom, like they're not developing those things. So our job is to say, hey, listen, this phone is one of many different things in your life. You can be on it for 2 hours, that's fine. But what are we going to do with the other 14 waking hours of their life? And we need to raise those other 14 hours so that we're blending their engagement with the rest of life, okay? This is a serious one because they're getting less and less engaged with areas of life. And we see this in the male and female differences. First, when we think about hormones, female hormones are, they cause us to long for connection. That's part of the way that God created us. Female hormones long for connection. Male hormones long for activity and doing things. That's somehow, some ways how kind of sometimes males and females can be wired a little bit differently in those things, okay? So the problem is when the connection is on the phone, there's a lot of harms. So the girls want to be connected. They want to be on Instagram. They want to see the pictures. They want to be in each other's lives. But there's a lot of negative things that come along with the phone. They're in harm's way with social comparison. Imagine like they're comparing themselves to other people 24/7 every time they see other pictures. Like, that's exhausting. That's absolutely emotionally exhausting. They say that Gen Z is the first generation ever in, like, being like a young generation. Like, when they would study different generations, they have less self-confidence than any other generation. And usually that's not the case with adolescents. Usually adolescents have a lot of confidence, especially in the older teen years where they think they can do anything and they think they're unconquerable. They're having less and less self-confidence because they're comparing themselves to everything else around them and they just don't feel adequate. So that's definitely an issue. And for males, this was really, really heartbreaking. It says, males have been slowly getting pushed out of the real world and pulled into the virtual world. Now, this goes with video games, avatars, AI girlfriends, pornographic distortions of sexual life, etc. So what we're finding is that the draw of tech for males is leading to less of an investment in school, in employment, in dating, in marriage, and in parenting. So it's not just girls with images on Instagram or TikTok. It's also guys loving this virtual world just enough to not want to invest in other areas of their lives as well. Now, if we keep looking at the social deprivation regarding gender, one issue is all of what AI can do with beauty. So this is an 11-year-old girl who thinks she should look like that. We know that that's not real. That's not even possible for her to look like that, but that's what her online world tells her. They're not able to differentiate at these young ages reality versus fantasy. So that's bad from an image perspective of like what we're supposed to look like for beauty, but also from a sexual perspective. Imagine that your first introduction to sexual stuff is really nasty, dirty pornography. You don't even have a chance to understand what like a real sexual development in life is because the distortion is so big, it's so radical. And if that's your first, like your first connection with that, they don't even understand, well, what's real and what's not, what's over-exaggerated. And so that is really, it's really a problem because they can't differentiate. They can't recognize what's real. Also, they're listening to a lot of influencers who are dictating their reality. Have conversations with your young people. What are influencers saying? And why do people listen to them so much? And then also, too, one other problem recognizing reality is there's so much content with kind of with gender dysphoria and with the LGBTQ community that they're getting a lot of that. It's making that lifestyle very normative because of places like TikTok and other places where after about four clicks, you're onto something that really like morally you shouldn't be onto. It only takes about four clicks to get to something pretty bad. And so they're seeing these inputs all the time. They're not cleansing their minds. They think that that's normal. And they can't recognize reality, that maybe that's not what we're going for, okay? So there are benefits of tech, absolutely. This, again, the goal is not to put down and get rid of everything, but I want you to recognize that the social risks and the physical risks, they're real. They're real, even if we can't prove it, they're real. There's something happening. These are not good things. And this is all a part of their online world all the time. So then how should we respond? What are we going to do? Well, first, let's look to Jesus. When Jesus saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. We heard that actually this morning in the session, right? Jesus loves young people. And I don't know exactly how he would react if he were here in our tech world. He would definitely call them to put down their phones and follow him and leave things. But he would also probably tell us that, yeah, this is what happens when you engage in these things. You know, it's a battle for the mind. I find this quote really interesting. It's not to desensitize what's happening, but it's just a fact. This is Dr. Vanderkolk, who wrote The Body Keeps the Score, if you've ever read that about post-traumatic stress and what's happening when we have traumatic experience. He says, if stress inputs are nonstop, meaning that 24/7 connection, if your executive brain function is low, meaning it's under development still in the younger years, And if you're trusting relationships to combat stress, like good relationships with adults in your life are limited, then anxiety, depression, suicide, and self-harm are normative responses to pain. The reality is what's going on behind a lot of this, this mental health, how mental health is coming out, is that there's pain. There's something not good going on at school, at home, in their social lives. And they're using the phone to kind of medicate and to overcome. But I really want you to think, you got to get under that. It's not just the addictive device or the habits, but there's something going on underneath it asking, well, what's happening? Some of the questions that you could ask are here in personal reflection. When you check your smartphone 10 times in 2 minutes, what are you looking for? And what if we actually answer that question? What am I looking for? When I scroll for an hour, what am I hoping to find? Especially when I promised myself I wouldn't do that again. Ask yourself, why am I feeling this way? What am I missing in my life? What am I not handling well? Child psychologists say that start having these conversations. Is your home, is your church, is your social spaces a place where you can actually talk to them about this stuff? It would be really great too, because you can have really interesting conversations. Another question we can ask ourselves is, why are we underprotecting our kids online? What's going on in our own parenting or in our own ministry that it's now the norm to let the iPad parent the child? We're so busy with our own lives, with our own careers, with our own phones, that it's just an easy way out and it has consequences, okay? Ask yourself, what boundaries do you have? You need boundaries. We all do. So what are going to be your boundaries for yourself, for your youth? And what's your next step after hearing this information? I want to show you guys two more slides before we do open up for questions. One is, when I heard all this the first time, inside of me, I wanted to fight. And that should be our reaction, is that we don't want to just passively sit back and let our generation get swept. It's not too late. We can't be passive. We actually have to be really active. And first, we have to recognize, who are we fighting? Well, we're fighting Satan, the hater of our souls, who wants to destroy all things all the time. Okay, that's not cliche, it's true. And remember, Satan is the father of lies. So when you look at social media use and tech use, listen for lies. Here's a couple of them. That'll never happen to me. Social media is not that bad. I can't be without my device. What if my kids can't get a hold of me? Well, you can't prove that the phone's causing it, so you don't have to pay attention. Okay, those are real excuses that we use. And I would say, those don't sound like fighting words. Those sound like passive, like I've given up kind of words. Also with big business, remember, big business wants your attention and your money, and they want to keep you engaged as long as possible. Big business doesn't want you to put parental controls on those phones. That's why, I don't know if you've ever tried controls. Sometimes they're not as easy to use as you think. They're a little bit complicated, and there might be a reason for that. I don't know. Don't forget that, you know, TikTok, you're several clicks away from seeing something that you absolutely should not see. Video games. Man, video games are a great money maker. Luckily, video games are not always the evil. Like, you have to have limits on your video games. And some people do get addicted, but the percentage is not that high. But video games, they make a lot of money off of us. Also, the beauty industry, the fashion industry, influencers, okay? So just remember, like, it's okay to fight against those things and say, no, you're not going to manipulate me and my time and my energy, okay? And then lastly, this is our digital wellness practice. I've given you some of these pieces of advice, but let's fill in the ones I haven't. Number one, I was shocked by this. They say that the young generation knows they're addicted. They're already tired of it themselves. They just don't know how to change it because they don't have those functions to like really be responsible with their gadgets. So number one, you need a plan. What is your plan? Don't sit back and think like we're just going to like get over this, because we probably won't. I already talked about two, dialoguing with young people, or with, not even with young people, dialogue with anybody. What are your boundaries? What are you going to do about this? Number three, remember the real purpose of the device. It's to communicate, and make sure you're using it for those reasons, but not overusing it for those reasons, okay? Agree on times of use, type of use, content type. Sometimes if we're talking about parenting, like, people stop parenting. Come on, you're the parent still. God, that is a God-given responsibility to you to still be the parent, and not to be intimidated by your kids, and to know they will rebel. And yes, it will be a battle, and sometimes it's a daily battle. But is that not what God's calling us to do, to love our kids and to help them function eventually as adults and move out as healthy young adults? You need accountability. You can delete and cancel accounts. Get rid of them. Change your passwords. Use the parental controls. My favorite one is number six. Like I said, you have 14 other hours of the day that you need to figure out, what are you going to do? Create a list of other things that give that take up our time. And with my kids, we have a checklist. Great. 2 hours of social media is one of like 15 things on this checklist. You guys got to do all those other things too. Rotate around. Once you've done everything that takes up the day, then maybe we can talk about watching another thing or playing another game or doing something. But, well, I need to help them understand what to do with their time. Seven is fabulous. Digital Sabbath. If you can get people to do a digital Sabbath once a week, suddenly the addiction is way reduced, because we all figured out, oh yeah, I can actually live a day without my phone. Do digital vacations. If you're signing your kids up for camp, find a camp that says, we're a device-free camp. Like, we're not doing devices for the week or the 2 weeks. Think about that. And then that helps them realize, oh yeah, I can live without my phone. Okay. Do a Bible read through the lens of addiction, or through the lens of tech use. It's funny, because there is no tech use in the Bible. But if we read the Bible through some of these topics, we say, okay, how does God want us to use our time? Or what does God think about our thoughts? Or what does God think about addictive behavior? And it's fun to kind of read scripture, trying to find those kinds of associations that we maybe didn't see the first time. And then lastly, the person who wrote the Anxious Generation, these are four of his recommendations. There are a lot of free play, lots of outside time. Someone came up to me after I read this in a different network, and he said, my daughter does a play wheel. She created this wheel, and the goal is to get 1,000 hours of outside play for her kids. And that, I don't know what the prize is going to be once they achieve those 1,000 hours, but they draw it in. There's 1,000 boxes trying to get 1,000 hours of outside play. That's awesome. I also read that people who play video games, just on average, at age 21, if you play video games like on a frequent basis, you will have played 10,000 hours of video games. Friends, that's what it takes to become an expert in anything. 10,000 hours of video games is what people are averaging at 21. I'm like, mamma mia, yikes. Let's just think about that and think, wow, we could really be strong in something else too if we even reduced our video game play by half. No smartphones before ninth grade. I know it's probably too late for some of your contexts, but that's what the recommendation is. They don't. They're 11 years old. They're 12 years old. They don't need to be on. Give them a Nokia. They can text. They can call. Yes, there will be social, what do you call that? Social consequences for that. In seventh and eighth grade, they can handle it still. However, the more people not doing it is better. That's why phone-free schools are really a thing. They're trending right now. Read about it. And we have to advocate for it, because a lot of parents say, well, no, I can't get a hold of my kid. Yes, you can. You call the teacher. You call the administrator. You can find your child in school. Let's stop making that an excuse. The parents are actually the ones keeping it from happening. Where wouldn't it be a treat if we gave children 6 hours of non-phone a day in the school classroom, where they check their phones in at the front, and then everyone doesn't have it? That's the collective solution. No one has it. So no one's worried about what her friend is doing, because her friend's not doing anything. She's sitting there learning. And then also, careful with those social media apps. Around age 16 is when young people can kind of start to handle them. If they get them earlier, they're just a lot more sensitive to struggle and to falling into those depressive and anxious things because their brain is just not ready to handle all of the negative stuff that comes with phone. This is my last slide. I'm going to show you resources. So up there is the Anxious Generation and the Center for Humane Technology. We see the surveillance capitalism content, the generational theory content. My favorite thing to do is just read. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. I just read books. So Teenage Brain and Brainstorm were some of my favorites. Over here on the left is the social media, the social dilemma, that documentary, the AI dilemma. If you're interested in kind of another layer of this, which would be AI, they did a great one. I just watched it the other day. But then here are two Christian resources. Unfortunately, there's not a lot, and I might be naive, but there's not a lot going on in the Christian world with this stuff. I have to go outside to kind of just whoever's studying this stuff. But the Culture Translator is a website with literally hundreds of parent guides. They're PDFs about 20 pages long. And like, for example, here it says, A Parent's Guide to Smartphones, A Parent's Guide to Teenage Slang, A Parent's Guide to Marijuana. And that's 3 out of 150 different parent guides. And it's not just a couple paragraphs, it's 20 pages of content. So I let the Culture Translator do the research and then I just read about it. What do I need to know? And that's been really helpful because they have a Christian worldview. And so that's been fun to read. And so they're a great site. It's good. I think their organization's called Axis. And then of course the Bible too. Friends, it's a battle. This is not gonna be easy, but the Lord is with us. We don't have to fear. He is over social media. He is over all of these things. This is my favorite and final slide. Remember, the mental health crisis is not too big for Jesus. The AI epidemic, the social media epidemic, it's not too big for him. And then also, what are you going to be controlled by? That we're called to be controlled by the Holy Spirit. And we need to put our lives in line so that he can be the one who controls us.